So I'm here with Anne Pringle Burnell. And I'm explaining to Anne that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And it's clear to me that you make at least some of your living, maybe your life, with the art of performing, singing. Would I be accurate?
Yes, I make, I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm a professional singer. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Good. Okay. So I only ask one question.
Okay.
And it is, as it regards this art to which you are giving some percentage of your life.
Yes.
Can you remember, can you tell me the very first time in your life when this appealed to you, you found yourself singing, people said, gee, you have a sweet voice, whatever it is? Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head. I always want to say shaking your head, but that's, you're nodding your head. So thank you very much. Yeah. What is it?
So the first time I felt like I wanted to do this, I aspired to be an actor.
Oh, hold on. Back
yeah.
up. There's nothing in your childhood? You didn't dance on the table or
sing
with kids or whatever?
In my childhood, we would make up plays, put on musicals, sing and perform for anyone would listen to my friends and I would.
Your friends and you?
Yes.
And how old were you when you were doing that?
Probably like 11 or 12, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, in summer camp, we would appear in different productions and, you know, that was just the highlight of it. I mean, always making up stories, making up things, you know.
Okay, so really it doesn't start with singing by itself.
No. Mm-mm.
It starts with performing.
Right.
Okay, so, do you remember that? Do you remember liking it, caring about it, being interested in it?
Yeah, I do remember. And I do remember, it's funny that you brought it up, because I remember the idea of like coming up with a story and then building on it. Oh, yeah, and then they went here. Oh, yeah, and then we did over there, you know, so just the story building on it and it growing and that creative process with other kids. You know?
This is really interesting because this, I would have thought that a child who was turned on by this mm-hmm. would be interested in playwriting or stories or
right.
something like that. So did you have those interests or you didn't or?
Well, I went to school for theater.
Whoa.
I jumped ahead too far.
Yeah, you did. You did, because I really, because there is an evolution to
yeah,
this,
there
right?
Is, right?
So some things have happened before you did that. So were you in plays in school?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did your family like it, think it was a good idea, wonder what you were doing? You know what I mean?
So I'll say that my mom was so supportive of everything I wanted to try, even though it was completely foreign to her. You know, she came to every little show that we did or every little, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then even when I went to college, she drove across the state to see every show. And my parents were both like kind of fundamentalist Christians. So they were like the theater and that whole scene was not really accepted by them, you know, but they still, you know, my mom definitely supported me 100%. She still supports every single thing I do.
Well, yeah, this is pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm, it is.
One might have expected that such parents would have frowned
down,
on,
yeah,
right, at
right.
the very least,
yeah.
right? So you were very lucky.
Yeah.
And also it's interesting that a child like you comes from that.
Yeah.
You know? So, okay, so this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that there's a childhood that's essentially filled with this stuff that you are really getting off on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you take any classes? Do you?
Yeah, there was a youth theater mm-hmm. in Kalamazoo where I grew up from age 7 on. And there was a Kalamazoo something youth theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, you know, summer productions, like repertory.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
And it was a big deal. And I got cast in one of the first shows. I think I might have been 14 or something like that. And so, like, my first experience on stage was then, you know. I got my first job at 14 as well. I was an ice cream scooper, so...
You were a good girl. You were a good girl. Okay, so it's real interesting. So one would have thought with all of this mm-hmm. that we would be looking at an acting career at the very least, or a playwriting career or
right.
something.
I did go that path.
Okay,
sure.
So at some point you say, I'd like to do this with my life, to yourself, mm-hmm. if nobody else, right?
Right.
And then your family says, okay, fine, major in theater?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I know.
Really amazing. You know how lucky you are, right?
Yeah. I know.
Okay, so you major in theater. Mm-hmm. So what are you thinking you're going to do then?
After?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think anyone who goes into the arts and then studies in the school really thinks about any kind of supplemental career. Maybe they should, you know. Should if I can't really perform and act in plays and sing and maybe I'll have business minor or something like that. And I didn't do that. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably good advice to kids nowadays. But
no, I think you're right. I think almost nobody does that unless their parents absolutely say, we won't pay for
yeah.
this unless you have.
Yeah.
Right.
So after acting school, I tried to decide if I was going to do a grad school or start a theater with some very creative, you know, very creative people in Chicago or New York. Those were our two, you know, places where we decided we were going to start a small theater company. And so I was kind of investigating all that, and while auditioning, some of the kids that I was, you know, working with and planned this thing with went off and did go to grad school or went into the profession, directly into the profession. So that kind of dispersed that little team of creatives, you know, and we were a hotbed in college together. So after that, I started auditioning in Chicago, and I went to New York for a short period of time because friends of mine were like, you have to move here. And I thought, well, I'm just going to try Chicago. So I auditioned for plays, and every single time, mind you, I was like 20, what are you when you get out of college? I was 22. So I was getting called back for like the leading lady parts with other 40-year-olds. So it would be right.
Wow.
Right. So it was that type of character that they saw me as, you know, that, I don't know, strong lead,
yeah,
you know,
mature.
Mature lady, right?
Right, right.
But I was only, you know, so every single time I was up against the same actresses, we were all called back to for the same jobs, and I never got it, you know? So at some point, I was waitressing in Chicago to hold the fort down, and there were two piano players there, and I started singing with them, you know, just kind of on a whim. Well, I know a couple of tunes. I knew like three songs, mm-hmm. you know, and I had sung in church choir and stuff like that, and I had sung in productions, but just background, you know, chorus stuff, and so. These piano players encouraged me. They took me around to hear all the old guys in Chicago, to hear all the standards they were playing in the Gershwin, the Porter, to hear the artistry. And so I got to know all these old piano men, or the masters and piano women that were playing in Chicago. And it was such a great dive into that material that I fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any money, really, so I would just have like one glass of champagne or something and just sip it all night long. Can I have more water, please? But I learned a lot, and if the place was slow, these guys would say, hey, come on over here, let me show you something. This is called back phrasing, or this is called da da da. So I got my
this is your training.
This was my training. So
amazing.
That really happened after college.
Wow.
And then I got, you know, well, I'm gonna go into the jazz realm and mm-hmm. try to sit in with these guys who really wanted instrumentalists to sit in. And they would make the vocalists like wait till the very last song of the evening to, you know. And then they were hardcore bebop guys, you know.
Uh-huh.
So they were just, you know, like making sure that I really didn't know where one was or the head was, you know. You know what I mean? It was just really, you know, and I just had to hold my own and do that. But I did get a gig. I got my first gig singing. A pianist gave me his, he's like, I'm going out on the road on tour. You know, I'd been sitting in with him in a blues bar. And he said, you can have the gig. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to put a band together. I have to learn more songs.
Uh-huh.
So I put an ad in the little newspaper, which was called The Reader in Chicago. And I got like a guitarist and a drummer and a pianist.
Wow.
So, yeah. So we had like this, we rehearsed and we took over the blues bar gig.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so then are you thinking, yeah, this is what I want to do?
Well, there was an interesting thing that happened. Well, it was interesting to me because as I started to approach that material that the pianists were teaching me and that the songs from the 40s and 50s, and I started singing them, and, you know, I realized that you have to be yourself. You're relating, like, everything. You're bringing your whole life experience to these songs. And so when you're singing a phrase, if you're really honest about it, it's going to be from you. The lyric is going to be truly from you. It could be you being satirical. It could be you being longing or sad, or it could be, you know, you're making fun of it or anything. You can, you know, turn a phrase. But I was really enjoying being myself,
mm-hmm.
and singing rather than being a character in a play.
Ah.
You see.
Yes, I do.
Singing someone else's feelings.
Yes, I do. And that's an interesting take on it that I don't think I've ever heard anybody say. And I also think that a lot of singers don't do that.
Oh.
They don't know it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So great, okay.
Yeah.
So you made a discovery that this way of being in the world, this thing which you can, that I'm assuming, it's clear, how much you were enjoying the singing, yeah. right? And then you get to do this other thing, which is really express yourself.
Right.
And that's really right. seductive.
Right. Well, that's a whole different level, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're actually sharing with the world
right.
your own experience, everything you bring to the table and whatever conflicts and things that you need to work out in your life, you're actually expressing. It's really like really being right here in the here and now.
Yes.
And so I started to enjoy that. And I actually said to my acting friends, you know, like, I really like being myself on stage.
Wow. Fascinating.
And
right, it is.
Right.
It is.
So,
and what did they say? Because so many actors do it so they don't have to be themselves.
Right.
So they can lose themselves in someone else. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I started just, you know, getting gigs. And I remember, I had that one little blues bar gig. And then I remember starting to put together like a show. There was a fancy club in town called Boombala. And it had a grand piano and like, kind of three quarters of the place would wrap around, you know, stage and the thrust stage, and you could get a whole band on there. And so I put together like a bunch of my best songs,
mm-hmm.
and negotiated a contract there, and then I did, you know, the little press release, and, you know, did all, mm-hmm. wrote it all, sent it to all the people, and made postcards, you know, like, you're really producing your
yeah.
own
yeah, yeah.
show, you know. And I got a call from the Chicago Tribune guy, and there's a backstory to this, but he had heard me, like, when I was singing as a waitress, I got up and sang with one of the guys
mm-hmm.
late one night, you know. And, well, he tells the story. Anyway, I'm not going to tell his story, but he heard me in a singing contest, and I was the waitress at the club where I worked, and I was the last person that the judges heard, because the owner said I wasn't allowed to join the singing contest the restaurant was having, because I worked there,
mm-hmm.
which is fair. So, but then at the end of the singing contest, the owner said to me, get up there and do a number because, you know, you sing better than all of them, you know, or whatever he said. And so I just was mad because I wasn't allowed to get in the contest, you know, so I wasn't afraid. And I got up there and I sang, and this writer from the Tribune was there. He was one of the judges. And he told me at the end of the night, like, you're wasting your life as a waitress. So I said, oh, really? Okay. You know, I filed that away. So then, you know, fast forward to my first show at Boombala, and I invited him, and he actually wrote back to me, or in those days, I guess he actually called me and said, was there no email? He said, you know, I'm coming to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, my God, I'm so nervous, you know. But I put a little, like, champagne, you know, thing on his table.
Nice.
And like, so that I would make sure that I treated him well. But, you know, I did all my best numbers that I had rehearsed with the guys and got a sax player. And so, anyway, he wrote like a big article in the Tribune. And so that was kind of like the birth of,
yes,
like, oh, I'm switching careers, you know, switching careers now. So, yeah. And, we're still friends. So he still has a radio show and he still writes for the Chicago Tribune. And he's just a loving person of the arts, you know, big fan of the arts.
And so how long ago was that?
It was 1987, I think.
Okay, so yeah. So you've been doing this now, I can't do the math.
32 years. Yeah.
Wow, okay, so that is clearly a career.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not sure how to do this. Do you want to talk about how you met Mark and how that got started, or?
Yeah, I think.
And then I'll ask him.
Okay. Yeah, he tells the story better, but I had a contract with a boat in Chicago. We don't have many boats, but one that goes from Navy Pier up and down the Lake Michigan, so it goes up like to Evanston and back again, and it's like a people sing and do dinner parties and stuff like that. I had a contract there as a band leader. And so I was singing there. It was like five nights a week. And then I also had to book lunches too. So it could be seven. I don't know. It was an insane job. And you could never be late because the boat would leave without you. So all the waitresses and waiters sang, right, and stuff. But I was the singer in the band and the leader. So I was on that, doing that contract, plus working like some temp job. Mark asked me out. He was like the substitute for the substitute piano player for the band upstairs. And so I was doing a little record at the time, and my producers were one of the substitutes, and he was like, you should go downstairs and harass Pringle on your breaks. So I'll let Mark tell the rest of the story.
All right. So you guys are based in Chicago?
Yeah.
Okay. And actually, why don't you talk about what you're doing now with the Chicago Cabaret?
In the year 2000, there was a cabaret, international cabaret conference that was at the Eugene O'Neill Theater in Waterford, Connecticut. And they would get a lot of Broadway people, a lot of music directors from all over the place. And Mark and I sort of had an act by then, and we were, you know, singing and playing together. And we were curious about this cabaret thing, and we auditioned for this conference. They only take like 30 people, and they really hadn't taken a duo before. And so they didn't really know what, you know, how to deal with it. But anyway, we both went as fellows of this international cabaret conference, which, you know, morphed, was at Eugene O'Neill for several years after that, and then it went to Yale. And and then Mark actually went back as a master teacher years later. So that was a cool thing in his career. So anyway, we got, you know, inundated with that training. It was a 10-day boot camp type thing where you just woke up and did nothing but this, you know, every single day. And you worked with all these master teachers like Margaret Whiting, mm-hmm, Julie Wilson. I mean, just amazing people. And they just kind of honed your storytelling skills, whether you could really convey the story, convey, mm-hmm, the emotion, can make them feel something, you know, mm-hmm, with the music.
Right.
And that's really...
That's what you wanted anyway.
Yeah, that was really blending my two crafts, my, mm-hmm, music and my acting,
right,
together.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So we took to it, and so we started doing cabaret shows in Chicago. We would open them there, and then we would take them to New York. We did about 5 years back and forth of that, and just kind of honing this. And cabaret shows just means that it's an intimate space, usually, although we've done them in major 500-seat theaters, too. But it also means that the people are, like, what they call breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
So they're... they're reaching out to the audience. They may actually talk with the audience, you know, on stage. So it's very much more like a concert, you know, things, not like theater. And so we started doing that. And we were also founding members of this organization in Chicago called the Chicago Cabaret Professionals. And we wanted to have a group like the Manhattan People, which was called the Manhattan Association of Cabarets. And so we're like, let's do it. We can just, you know, have the same group here. And, you know, we would meet in people's basements or living rooms and like-minded people, you know. So fast forward 20 years later, the organization is a not-for-profit, and it's been going 20 years. We just had our 20-year celebration, like, last year. I can't believe that it's survived this long, but it's this, the difference between this organization and the New York one is that this one is member run. So the members actually run the whole organization, vote for their board of directors. We try to raise money and stuff, but there's not really any artistic director telling us, you know, what to do. And
so what is the event that's coming up?
Oh my gosh. Well, so we were always doing, you know, big productions. We found that when we worked all together, like if singers and artists can organize, man, you have a lot bigger voice.
Ah.
You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. the big thing I would tell people. Like the jazz people in Chicago, they have the Jazz Institute, but that's run by some other people. It's not member run, you know?
Right,
so,
right.
And the they have lots of organizations like that, but the cabaret is member run. And so when we banded together and we're like, well, let's each do three numbers in the show and let's do, you know, we're going to make a tribute to the Gershwins mm-hmm. and tell about their story. And so we started approaching theaters when they were having their dark nights, like Mondays, they're usually off, or Sunday nights. And we started doing big productions like that in these theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put it on their series, and it was very successful. So that's why we kind of branched into bigger shows. So last year, a group of little cabaret organizations, like a charitable one called Acts of Kindness Cabaret, they have a Paris connection. We went to Paris with them this September, working in concert. They are made up of the Cabaret Connexion and also Bellissima Opera. And the Cabaret Project, which is more burlesque
mm-hmm.
and drag, and then Chicago Cabaret Professionals. So four not-for-profit organizations had coffee together and wine, and we decided, hey, what if we make like a festival and we'll call it Chicago Cabaret Week, and we'll just kind of oversee it. We'll invite all these venues to be part of it, and we'll invite all these artists to submit their shows, like mm-hmm. shows they've already done that had good reviews and stuff like that. And we'll, you know, vet everything, and we'll present it to the venues, and the venues will just kind of handpick the shows they want. It was a big dream. My friend Claudia kind of came up with it. And so venues are not used to chasing the artists, right?
Right.
So
That's right.
We were kind of turning the river direction, right?
Right, right.
So we did it. We made the big website with everyone's shows and information and stuff. And then the venue contacted the artists. It was like they went shopping.
Oh, that's amazing.
So they went shopping and they were like, well, I want, you know, the
one of these
London shows. I want this. And so they contacted the artists, and there was a little scramble, like who could get the artists, you know?
Right.
But it was well organized. They had about 2 months to do their shopping, and some of them needed some hand-holding, like, you know, are you going to pick your shows, or what can we do to help you? And so after that, then we let the artists know which venues were involved. They could go after venues that hadn't booked yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that all the process, you know, was like all this summer. And when we wrote a grant for this, we didn't get the first grant. But anyway, we got the attention of the Tourism Board of Chicago, which is
so
Chicago. And they thought, this is kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah.
And so they came on board as our sponsor.
Wow.
So they're our media sponsor, and they also invested some money for the printing of the materials and mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. And we've been meeting with them for a year. And it's been really exciting. And about, I don't know, June or July, they said to us, well, you guys, there might be something going on next year that could be really good for you. And like, we can't tell you what it is yet. And I go, oh, okay. So we still meet with them and we're doing all this work. And then it came out that the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, and the commissioner, Mark Kelly, had decided to call next year, or this year, 2020, the year of Chicago music. And this will be the first time that Chicago is, they call it, turning the spotlight on Chicago artists. So it will be a huge collective effort with funding, with advertising, with the tourism board, with everything, shining a light on all that we have to offer in Chicago.
Wow.
Now, everyone knows what New Orleans has to offer.
Right.
Everyone knows, you know, like...
what New York has to offer.
What New York has to offer, right? They really don't know where to find this type of music in Chicago or any type of music. And so, and the other thing about Chicago is that we had, you know, the blues guys were over here, the house guys were over here, the gospel people were here, and all our festivals were separated by genre like mm-hmm. that.
Right.
And they still are. But this was the first time they called us all together.
Wow.
Every musician.
Wow.
Every producer, every club, every presenter, every agent who represents artists.
Yes.
From big to small. So Grammy to, you know, just starting out. That whole...
My God.
Plus we have a legacy committee of people researching of all our history that we have in Chicago, like Chess Records and stuff. So this is going to be, when we were all in the room together, and I was at a table of 12 people from the Sinfonietta to rap, my hair on
I'm
my...
I'm sure. Talk about being in your community with your homies.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like we were at the city of Chicago's cultural center, and we were supposed to come up with ideas of the themes of next year. Blah, blah, blah. And I was so excited, and I've been on fire ever since about mm-hmm. this whole project. All the funding for the arts that's happening is coming through now, so we're in a grant writing frenzy right now for projects that we want to do in the schools, and it's really made us aware as a musical community of the pockets of underserved communities.
Wow.
And so everyone's like on the same page that we want to really cultivate some things on the south and west side of Chicago.
It's also, there's a generation that's interested in, especially cabaret or jazz, it's dying.
Yes.
So if the...
We don't cultivate a new audience,
no,
right?
No, it's gone.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's happening in Chicago.
It's happening everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not only that, it's happening in the opera, it's happening in the theater, it's happening everywhere. This generation that was interested in the arts in that way is dying,
right.
And they, for some reason, did not pass it on.
Well, there was a lot of, think of, you know, like, we had band, we had choir in school.
Oh, yes, that's right. Right, right.
Like, all those programs have been cut.
So where are you in this?
So I joined the board, and then I am currently the president of Chicago Cabaret, and I am working with these other three organizations. You know, we have the Cabaret Week happening. They're all over Chicago, and Choose Chicago, the tourism board, has built a website of all the shows that you can get tickets to. And
yeah, why don't you say what the website is, if you know?
It's chicagocabaretweek.org, and also the cabaret.org is just the not-for-profit supporting this art form, and you can be a friend or a member or anything. You can just sign up for the mailing list and find out more about the shows.
Okay, you don't have to live in Chicago.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have one final question.
Okay.
And it is, having given as much of your life as you have to music, to performing, to cabaret, what would you say about what that's like or what it means to you or what you think about it?
Okay. So I'm going to go back. When I was working in all the nightclubs and the boat and, you know, all these weddings and doing all the contracting work,
you know, a lot of the music scene changed, and we did morph into cabaret, so we were able to change with that scene. And so it didn't matter if a lot of the jazz clubs closed, because I was still working in the theaters on off nights. Like we said, we were still producing our own group shows and then taking our own theme shows to New York. So I feel like we didn't really get hit with a recession kind of that happened to music clubs.
Right.
As much. And we definitely do a boatload of private parties, you know, at racket clubs and all that kind of stuff. But I feel like you really have to be clear that you are on this mission to share your art form. You have to be very clear that you're an artist. And so, 4 years ago, we went to Panama with a group of people. In my other career, I was really having a lot of success in, which is the aquatics and movement, therapeutic movement and Pilates and stuff. So we went there and we ended up singing at the resort there, which we just did this year too. Mm-hmm. And these people all of a sudden were like, at the resort, you know, I stood up just like I did in Paris with no microphone, right next to the piano, and everyone just came closer, you know? So I was reminded again, like in 2016, and it put out an album the year before, that like, yes, really spending time on this and really creating art is the most important thing. It was rewarding to be seen as an artist, and it's how you have to approach your, you know, your life to the world. You can't just say, oh, yeah, I'm a, like, my hobby is singing and, you know, because this, because it doesn't ever feel like that.
No.
So on my tax records, maybe I make, you know, a third of my money this way and two-thirds of this money, you know, but on my, how much time and how much joy and love and life force that I feel, you know, it's really in the art form. And now I didn't even know that I was good at kind of running a not-for-profit. I have an understanding of what it needs to be in the world and how important those organizations are, because those not-for-profits keep people focused on, like, putting out art into the world, you know. And so you can do it as an individual, but you can also consider, like, finding some like-minded people, like the Jazz Club of Sarasota, you know. Mm-hmm. Finding some like-minded people and banding together and like to produce things too, because there's a lot of power in that.
That's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Anne. So I'm here with Mark Brunell, and I'm explaining to Mark that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And so it seems to me that you are making much of your living, all of your living, some of your living, much of your life with the art of music, both playing and singing. Is that accurate?
It is. It's actually all of my life, all of the time. I've been a full-time musician for a whole life.
How amazing is that? Okay, so I only ask one...
I pinch myself, yes.
Yes,
I'm
really.
I'm lucky.
Really, I don't blame you. So I only ask one question, and it is, can you tell me, the very first time in your life when music attracted you, called you, seemed interesting to you?
Wow. My mother's side of the family was very big, and we had Christmas parties. And I remember as a young child, the relatives bringing out the guitars and singing, doing big sing-alongs. And I liked that almost as much as Santa, you know. So, you know, it made a big effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
But I really have to go beyond that into first grade through sixth, because unlike a lot of people, one of my very best teachers was my elementary school music teacher. And this includes 5.5 years of instruction at Carnegie Mellon. This man was a magician. Mr. Zanna was his name. He had kind of a fun name. And going to music class was I just pretty much lived for that. We were already singing three-part harmony in fourth grade. And
wow.
This man was just magnificent. So that was a huge jump start. So if I think way back, that he would, you know, that would
yeah, be but I forgive me. It's what I'm finding myself thinking is that you were already predisposed. Not every kid might have had the same response, but you had all of that experience of people that you love loving music. You think not?
Oh, I did. It was important. It was my mom's dad who came over on the boat around the turn of the century, from Galicia, so that's Polish-Ukrainian descent, and he played harmonica, fiddle, sang, accordion. So that's genetically where I get it, but I had a lot of uncles and aunts and cousins that were very musical. So when the sing-alongs that I mentioned, yes, that was important.
So this teacher picks up on that. I mean, here you have somebody who's helping you do more of that, have more of that in your life. Hmm? Okay, good. So so you're singing and you're loving it. And is there chorus? Is there choir? Are you singing other places?
Absolutely. We had we'd choirs all through elementary school, junior high, and high school.
At some point, are you thinking, I'd like to do this with my life?
Well, the big break, as I see it, was when I was 8 years old. My dad we grew up in the country, and I played in the woods all day. But my dad belonged to the sportsman's club. He shot archery, and he had a pickup truck, and they were giving away an old piano. And all he needed was a couple of guys to load this beat up old upright piano onto the pickup truck, and he was able to take it home. And they were thinking, of course, my mom and dad thought my younger sister, 5 years younger, would eventually play it. But who graduated to it? And I made a beeline for that piano. And of course, the end result was they gave me piano lessons.
Oh, wow.
And I started at age 8 in third grade, and I never stopped.
Wow. Okay. So it sounds like you always knew this was what you were going to do with your life. There wasn't some moment. Oh, maybe there was a moment.
Well, I don't know if it was a specific moment, but as I progressed through school, you know, I would accompany the choirs and then would play for the school productions. And I think I knew probably around, I think 10th grade. I knew at that point, this is what I want to do. So I took I loaded my schedule with as many music classes as I possibly could. And in the Pittsburgh area, the obvious choice for music to study was Carnegie Mellon.
Carnegie Mellon.
So I auditioned and luckily was accepted, and that was there my path was chosen then.
Yeah, so it was pretty simple for you.
Well, I don't know about simple.
Well, I didn't mean that it was easy. I meant that you were drawn to this.
Oh,
you were
clear.
Captured by it. It was clear. You didn't have to struggle over, you know, right? And your parents apparently didn't give you any flack over it. They didn't say, what are you going to do to make a living?
I'm so grateful my parents. Of course, they would have preferred that I, you know, be an engineer or anything else. You know,
right, right,
something
right,
that
right.
could maybe make some money and have a solid career. But they were supportive, and I feel very lucky. And,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of made a deal. Well, if you get an education degree, you know, we'll support it. So I went an extra year and got my first degree was in piano performance, a bachelor's in performance, music performance. Then I went to get my master's in music education.
Wow. Okay, so you graduate, and then what do you do?
Another lucky break. a big time lucky break. Just when I got out, after the fifth year, a job opened up for a pianist at Carnegie Mellon, the school I just spent 5 years at.
Doing what?
Well, they had, at this point, very, well, exceptionally strong music theater program in the drama department.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a couple of pianists that were required to play for productions, help to train the singers, play for voice lessons,
mm-hmm.
and blah, 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 blah. And there was an opening. And I thought, wow, wouldn't this be perfect? And I auditioned for that, and I got the job, and I just seamlessly left. I didn't leave college. I stayed there. Mm-hmm. So I remained there for another 10 years.
Wow.
And until I moved to Chicago. But I was working for the drama department in music theater, and I was a jazz lover. And of course, as I just loved improvising, loved changing all the songs that I didn't like playing it the same way. And although I was studying classical music and I was required to learn Bach and Mozart and Beethoven and play it the way it is on the ink.
Yeah.
I always liked to fake it and improvise it. So luckily they had a jazz band, a big band at Carnegie Mellon, and I started playing for that as a sophomore. And I did that for years. So as the years went on, I played more improvisational music and less classical. And this music theater was perfect because, you know, a lot of those scores you can't play exactly. You sort of fake them, and the songs are in the wrong key.
So yeah, I was just going to say, right. Mm-hmm.
Move it down a third. Sure, you know, that was fine. But since jazz was such a strong love for me, I found some people that wanted to sing in a vocal jazz ensemble type of a group, something like the Manhattan Transfer.
Mm-hmm.
So three or four of us started what is now the Carnegie Mellon Jazz Choir. So I did that for 5 or 6 years at Carnegie Mellon. So I was working for both departments. That was the music department. So the first year it was, there were two directors. We were co-director. And the second year she moved to New York. So it was
just you.
It was just me. and I continued, I cleverly started a professional quartet called Jive, and it was capital letters and periods. It stood for Jazz Improv Vocal Ensemble.
Cute.
And I took the best of the students from the vocal jazz ensemble, made it into a little quartet. We played around the Pittsburgh area, and we played clubs and festivals and concerts. And so that way I was able to do the jazz. So here I am playing jazz, and then I was playing music theater, and then I joined a band that we did club dates, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 gigs a week. And that was just a quartet with bass, drum, singer, and keyboard. So I got that way I learned how to use the electric keyboards. Back then in the 80s, keyboards didn't do multiple sounds. You had to have a different keyboard for everything.
Right.
So it was multiple keyboards. And I learned the whole electronics through all of that. So, and then I had that various church jobs. So I just sort of waded into the music world and did what I could. Singing and playing.
I take it back. It was easy. It did seem to morph for you without a lot of struggle that you were able to do what you wanted to do. Does that not feel right?
I think I was so lucky. I think
the
cards were just, I just stumbled onto wonderful things, and they appeared for me. I had some lucky breaks. I really did.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like that. Okay, so here you are doing everything that you want to do, right? Your life is filled with all of these things that you actually want to do. So maybe you should tell me how you met Ann.
Ah, yes. So this path that I described of all this music making lasted about 10 years, and I gradually got a little bit restless, you know, Pittsburgh being a small town.
Mm-hmm. You did say you moved.
I moved to Chicago, and
why did you choose Chicago?
Well, at first, I looked at L.A. I had some students and friends out there that were working, and I did some visits, and I traveled there, and it seemed interesting, except a lot based on recording. And I kind of realized I'd be holed up in a recording studio all day, and I really liked performing.
Ah.
And then I made a few trips to New York. Carnegie Mellon sent me there on occasion to play auditions. So I got a taste for that. But growing up in the country and being a little bit relaxed, New York was a little frantic for me. You know, you meet somebody, hello, who are you? What do you want? Get out of my face, you know. So those two coastal giant cities had flaws. And then I went to a vocal jazz ensemble camp, one of those things in Michigan, and had a chance to visit Chicago, and I really fell in love with the city and kind of thought, well, maybe this is going to work. Mm-hmm. And then I met the wrong girl, you know, quote unquote.
Uh-huh.
And you know, we lived together for my first 3 years in Chicago. I say wrong girl. It was certainly, there were a lot of right things about it.
Yeah, no, I.
But it didn't end up, you know, in the cards being a forever type of a thing. And then after we broke up, I was already in love with Chicago, with its music scene, and mm-hmm. just, you know, I went from a small town Pittsburgh to a giant town Chicago, and all its music history and all its blues and jazz, and I was just loving it, and doing much of the same thing, teaching at colleges, playing in bands, you know, church music, all of it. And then I met the right girl.
Mm-hmm.
So we met on a boat. She was doing singing a whole summer of leading a band on the Spirit of Chicago, which was around Navy Pier, and it had two floors and two bands, and I was a one-night substitute for the keyboard player, actually a sub of a sub, for the other band.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Oh, check out this Ann Pringle girl. She's a friend of mine. You know, you'll like her." And yeah, I really liked her. So that's how we met on this gig. And I said, "Do you want to go to the Drake Hotel to hear Buddy Charles, who was our legendary kind of our Bobby Short? He mm-hmm. you know, knew every song and was a great entertainer, a wonderful comedian." And we went to hear him, and that was our first date. And it was actually a little bit comedic. We plopped ourselves down on these wonderful bar stools at the exotic Drake Hotel, and we're listening to Buddy. And 20 minutes go by, and Ann's purse is stolen. Somebody reached into the well, and of course, Buddy was giving me flack about it. "How could you let that happen?" And I said, "Buddy, I wasn't looking at her purse." And this all was very funny.
Right.
So I gave her cab money, and I thought, I better try to save this. What's the safest possible next date? I said, "You want to go for a bike ride?" It was summer.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Sure." So in between our first date and our second date, my bicycle was stolen off the street. So I showed up on a unicycle, and that, which is one of my hobbies, and that was our second date. She rode a bike, and I rode a unicycle, and our relationship took off. The crime wave stopped, and we started to make music together. And she had her own band, and I had a vocal ensemble at that point. When I moved to Chicago, I continued the vocal jazz. That was a big love of mine. So I started teaching, directing the vocal jazz ensemble at Northwestern. I did that for a couple of years. And then I started teaching vocal jazz at Roosevelt University.
Mm-hmm.
And I started another professional quartet. This time we called ourselves Cooler by the Lake. We stole that from the weathermen. They would say, "Oh, in Chicago, it's going to be 65 degrees, but cooler by the
cooler
lake."
Cooler by the lake.
So it was much the same of kind of a Manhattan Transfer type of an SATB, two guys, two girls, four-part vocal harmony. And,
mm-hmm.
and that was my group, and Ann had her group. But gradually, as we stayed together and continued to date, we worked up our own act.
Yeah.
And we started playing together as a duo and you know, and forming little bands among ourselves. And then a couple of years later, we got married. That was 25 years ago. So we've known each other for 27 years and been married for 25.
And you do this all over. You do the duo all over, right?
Well, I guess all over the world, if that counts, but mostly in Chicago. But we've
mm-hmm.
played overseas.
In
Paris and Caribbean.
Sarasota.
Sarah's now we have Florida on our radar.
All right.
We can't wait to spend more time down here.
No, it's heaven. It is heaven. Okay, I actually only have one more question.
Wonderful.
And it is, having spent a life in music, which you clearly have, is there anything that you would say about what that's like or what it means to you or what you think about it?
Well, I think I've used the word lucky too much, but I do consider myself very fortunate that the thing that I'm most passionate about, music, I get to do it as a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say have to or do it for a living. I get to. It's an opportunity for me. I'm just blessed. I just thank God, and I just thank all the lucky breaks in my life and the circumstances. And of course, I knew it wasn't going to be, lots of dollars and a glorious, rich lifestyle. But it didn't matter to me. I just want to make music. I love entertaining for people. I love their changing their mood and their life by performing for them. I like to train singers and make them better and accompany them. And this is just joy, utter joy for me. And the fact that I get to do it and be able to pay the rent is, that's a good life for me.
And that is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.